Great. Hopefully this works. All right. I think the transcriber also works. Great. All right. So, welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Welcome everybody. So today we're very pleased to have Joni and Gregory from DIACC, Digital Identity and Authentication Council from Canada, to present 10 Canadian Trust Frameworks. Before that, I just want to quickly go through a couple administrative agendas. First of all, just a quick reminder on the Code of Ethics and Professional Conduct. Just want to make sure we have conversations and discussions. I think we've been doing that. Please continue to do that. Second, just want to make a quick note on the intellectual property. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So if you have any questions in regards to the agreement or the W3C account, please feel free to reach out to any of the co-chairs. Couple quick call notes. These meetings are being automatically recorded and transcribed. We will publish the meeting minutes, the transcriptions, the audio and video recordings in the next 1 to 2 days. We use GT chat to queue the speakers. You can type in Q plus to add yourself to the queue or Q minus to remove. And you can type in Q question mark to see who's in the queue. All right, I think it's time for the introductions and reintroductions. So if you're new to the community or you haven't been active and want to re-engage, please feel free to just unmute. You don't have to type in Q+, you can just unmute and introduce yourself. Don't be shy, it's okay. I'm not gonna call on people though, but if you feel brave and just unmute and introduce yourself to the community.
Hello, I'm Ricky NG Adam. So my introduction is I'm working at the Quebec Cybersecurity and Digital Effort for Digital Identity for our citizens. So I'm happy to join here. Looks like a quite interesting effort. Thank you.
Great. Welcome, Ricky. Anyone else? All right, any announcements or reminders? Anyone have upcoming events they want to announce or remind the community about? Clea, please.
Yeah, we've got the Internet Identity Workshop coming up October 29 to 31st. We have a bunch of sponsorship opportunities still available, and they are very affordable. Let's just say sponsoring IIW can cost you as much as going to another conference. So, I'll just put that out there if folks want to connect. And early bird pricing ends, I think, at the end of this week. So, please get registered if you want that price. And then we also have the DID on Conference Africa happening in Cape Town, September 25th to 27th.
Great. Thanks, Clea. Any other announcements or reminders? So a quick preview of what's coming. So next week we'll have Greg come back again to follow up and wrap up on the conversation in regards to anonymous holder binding. And then the week after that, we actually invited people from the nonprofit Open Mind to talk about, they're a nonprofit around AI governance. So change a little bit topic to talk about their work there. And then the week after that, we have Wayne to talk about provably forgotten signatures. So that's what's coming. All right. Last calls for announcements and reminders. All right. Any notes on the work items? So we've scheduled a couple sessions in regards to different work item updates in the next few weeks. So please stay tuned. And we'll have another open discussion on the work items in quarter four of this year. All right, so let's get to the main agenda. So as I stated earlier in the call, very excited to have this conversation, very excited to have Joni and Gregory from DIACC to talk about Pan-Canadian Trust Frameworks. This topic is dear to my heart. I think a lot of times, most of the time, we talk about digital signatures, we talk about cryptography, we talk about selected disclosures, but I think one of the key things in regards to ensuring the identity, self-sovereign identity can be realized is trust frameworks and governance. So this is a very interesting topic, and I really look forward to Joni and Gregory's presentation. All right, Joni, Gregory, the floor is yours. Thank you.
All right, so I'll take over the first bit, and I'll share my screen. Can everybody hear me okay? There's a lot of background noise here.
We hear you, Greg.
Okay. Hopefully you're looking at a PowerPoint presentation.
Not yet.
There you go. Is it up on screen?
No.
Gregory, it should be the third button. Oh, there we go.
Yeah, I don't think it's the buttons here. It's the security settings on my Mac.
Got it. We can see your full entire screen, by the way. That's just the window.
There's nothing. Okay. There's nothing here confidential. So. There, that should do it. So, just a quick clarification for Harris. Joni is the president of the Digital Identity and Authentication Council of Canada. I'm a business and information analyst working at Portage CyberTech. So I don't. But I've done a lot of work with DIAC, and so when Harrison first mentioned about trust frameworks. You may recall late in the spring, I thought, well, we've got a whole background on trust frameworks through the Pan-Canadian Trust Framework. But before we get to some details on that, and I turn it over to Joni, I thought I'd present some context because we're shifting gears a little bit here. My own personal background is I'm not a computer scientist. By training, I'm a librarian. I have a master's degree in library and information science. So the DIDs, DID methods, JSON data structures is all important, but we're going to shift away a little bit from that to how a lot of those technical solutions get fully adopted and how we can generate trust in a security and identity context that very quickly expands beyond the context of a single organization. This is particularly important. My own background is about 20 years of government, Canadian public sector services, moving those online, and the constant push for better, faster, more integrated service delivery is the context we're coming from. So it's a very basic agenda. I don't think we'll need an entire hour to run through it, but we're looking at, in terms of the trust frameworks, how do we de-risk the adoption of digital identities and related cybersecurity initiatives to get the trust needed for meaningful digital services online? And in part, that's responses to the changing online service demands, a decentralized and self-sovereign identity of which all of the good W3C verifiable credentials are essential, but it is shifting, and how do we how do we deal with the fact that that entire ecosystem that shows up in the verifiable credentials data model, how do you build the trust between everybody in that ecosystem and across the board in the absence of what you might call a formal commercial framework like that exists in the financial sector, in the banking world, and the credit card world, and things like that. So the way I've framed this is, and a lot of this will not be new or particularly revelatory to the people on this call, but moving digital services demanding is on trust. We need a level of trust that's difficult to get online. There's a great volume of personal information involved, and it's, you know, particularly for high value, high risk interactions. And what I mean by that are things like moving transactions, remote transactions for not just buying and purchasing, you know, your toothpaste from Amazon, but buying and selling houses and dealing with the requirements for a remote identity verification in the legal sector, which is something that DIAC is now looking at. Of course, all of that is undertaken within an environment where people expect convenient, seamless, integrated. They want their service experience to be like that. They want privacy. They want consent. They want transparency. They want the right to be forgotten. And they want it all to be simple and easy. And, of course, none of this is particularly simple and easy when you get down into the technical weeds of it. What it has done, though, I would argue, is the dominant digital identity and security models are now strained. Centralized identity, meaning, you know, your username and password that serves one particular company or service, has reached its peak. We know the limitations of it. Expanding beyond that single identity context is difficult. And the other thing that often gets lost in the technical discussions is it's also incredibly expensive for a small and medium enterprises and for local governments that simply don't have the resources or even the mandate in some cases to develop and put together a complete digital identity solution that can be fully integrated with every other government around them. So, but if we don't get and meet these requirements and expectations, all the promise of, you know, the cyber economy, the digital economy become harder to realize, particularly if you're in Canada. This is particularly true if you look outside of the main cities and urban areas. It is very difficult to move a lot of this into the Arctic regions. It's just not that simple. I thought I'd throw in just a few statistics that DIAC has collected with digital identity. People, and these date back a little bit. Joni, you can correct me, but they're going back about, what, 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. So most people see the benefits, but there's a large percentage of about a quarter that are highly skeptical about, you know, sharing their personal information, giving it over to government, integrating and linking everything up. But a lot of people are interested in learning more about it. The digital wallet concept is becoming more familiar and gaining popularity. I would say largely through the efforts of Apple and Google here. And only about 14%, you know, are completely unfamiliar with what that means. So we do have a user population out there that's educated, not 100, no, they may not be technical experts, but they see the potential benefits of this, but it's that highly skeptical, core that we have to address to a certain degree. So how do you do that? Well, we've all seen this. IT security is an issue. We have lots of personal information all scattered across disconnected databases all over the place. Some of them connected to the internet, some not. Doesn't matter. It's still a target for a hacker. They're often protected by weak authentication or at best usernames and passwords. And of course, they're all susceptible to social engineering attacks, whether it's a publicly facing database or just a internal facing business system that falls prone to employees that can be scammed just as easily as anybody else. Federated identity, of course, that's been on the scene for a while. Offset the cost, you get a better client experience. You can outsource some of your core ID functions to trusted parties. But what happens, and this is the core, I would think, of where the trust framers come in, is your trust domain starts to extend beyond your direct control. Your corporate IT perimeter, your corporate security perimeter just exploded. So what's the response over the last couple of years? Better IT security, multi-factor and adaptive authentication. I don't like having Microsoft Authenticator installed on my phone, having to enter codes all the time, but I understand that why the company does it. End-to-end encryption, minimizing data access privileges, and data loss prevention, all of that rolling up into the zero trust security model, which is good. I would argue it's inappropriate, but it doesn't resolve every issue. You're still collecting lots of personal information if you're a large service provider. I'm not even talking here surreptitiously like Google trying to collect everything and anything about you as you search through. I'm just the information collected to actually legitimately offer you a service online. There's redundant collection. I see this because in the information analysis part, it's almost impossible to find two systems that actually don't have any overlap and share information. And you've got data discrepancies. You've got privileged accounts that still exist that can be compromised. And you're still in a security arms race with malicious actors. And they are always going to be trying to get in there. So you've always got to be watching what you're doing. And we see it with all, we saw it with the CrowdStrike failures of a few weeks ago. Of course, the other response, decentralized identity, which is where I have a verifiable credentials play in, draws heavily on that. We want to eliminate the number and the size of the repositories that centralize personal information. Basic model, as everybody here knows, keep the personal information with the owner, decentralizing storage and control of it, often using technology that mimics physical identities, where you can pull out your driver's license and give it to the police officer or the person that wants to try and verify your identity, but with more privacy because you're not handing over, you're not oversharing. So you get better privacy and transparency. You can consolidate digital identities into one interface, but your trust domain is still beyond the direct control of your organization or your service provider. You're still that, those credentials, those identities, those verifiers are all part of a broader ecosystem, which in a very simplified way, we've kind of described as being consisting of three groups. There's the solutions and the providers at the bottom. That is the W3C, the community standards groups. NIST is a big one in there. They are the ones that develop technical standards. In many cases, they develop the open source code that can be put out into the community and rolled into commercial and other products. There are the adopters at the top of the screen there who have a certain duty of care to their clients to meet, not only to meet their expectations, but increasingly to meet legal and regulatory requirements. And they're on the front line of those expectations and want to be able to offer the kinds of services and experiences that their customers want. And just as a side note, that is a Hyundai logo. I couldn't find a logo that would suffice for all adopters, all service providers. I chose that one because allegedly it's supposed to be a stylized version of two people shaking hands. I guess agreeing to buy a Hyundai vehicle, but in my non-working life, I have an interest in cars, so that's why I picked that one. If you're wondering where that relationship came from, So what bridges in between these groups, the solution providers and the adopters, that's where the trust framework comes in. And in this case, what we can talk about most authoritatively is the DIAC and its Pan-Canadian Trust Framework. But there are others out there. Australia, the United Kingdom have them. They've all been working on them. Singapore does. I think even maybe the Philippines, where they're looking at trying to develop auditable outcome-based criteria against which the participants in the verifiable credential and digital identity ecosystems can be assessed. And whether that's a formal assessment by an auditor or just a self-claim that says, look, this is how we go about doing our business. This is the technical standards we meet. This is how we implement it. This is the process we use for identity and verification. These are the process we use for verification and revocation of our verifiable credentials. And most of them are based on the recognized schemes that are coming out of the solutions and the providers themselves. So that's where we're kind of positioning the trust framework is not technical, not entirely legal and regulatory. And in fact, in the Pan-Canadian experience, we had to make quite clear that the trust framework did not supersede or negate any legal or regulatory requirement that a member had if they were participating in or adopting the framework. That's not the intent. The intent is to supplement the often convoluted and sometimes dated legislation that doesn't move at the same speed as the technical sector, and fill that out and try and provide guidance to the adopters that are looking at it. In this case, I'll refer back to the legal community coming to DIAC and looking for guidance on how they can best do remote identity verification for their members. And with that as a context, I think it's best to hand it over to Joni, who's the president and can speak much more authoritatively on DIAC and the trust framework itself.
Thanks, Greg. Excuse me. It's great to be here with this group today. Thank you for the invitation. It's great to see names that I've known and am familiar with, and also those that are new. So thanks for the time today. About the DIAC, we are a nonprofit association, and we were created as a result of the global financial crash in 2008-2009. The Department of Finance at the federal level put together a task force to review our payment system and to look at our payment system in the context of what was happening globally and make recommendations for how our payment system could be, you know, what was working and where we needed some areas for improvement within our payment ecosystem. Out of that payment task force, that included public and private sector subject matter experts, was a series of recommendations toward what our payment system would benefit from, and the recommendations that were the mandate for our organization to be founded were that we needed our payment system would benefit from a digital identity and authentication framework, that framework should be developed through collaboration of the public and private sector, and that framework should be developed, that collaboration should be hosted under a self-governing body. So those three recommendations were the foundation for how our organization was founded. And the organization was founded by a group of financial institutions, telecommunications provider, and federal government and provincial governments. Today, our board includes representation from organizations small, medium, and large, Canadian and multinational, and provinces including British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec, and New Brunswick, helping to bring together a common views around digital identification and authentication. We're about 85 members you know, up in terms of our size. And we are, we've actually evolved our mission, and we're focused on, what we've learned, and Greg showed some stats, but we've learned that digital ID or digital identification is confusing to most listeners. When we're speaking to experts or people who are working in this space, like people in this call, you understand it. When we're speaking to the adopters, of these types of technologies and capabilities, they don't always understand what digital ID means. And sometimes they think it means something completely different, than what we are intending. And we also in the Canadian ecosystem, I would say, in my experience, suffer from quite a bit of misinformation and disinformation, which is one of the factors in a public trust gap around adopting, you know, emerging and existing technologies. And so we do work as an organization to advance what we now call digital trust. So these are the suite of capabilities and tools to help people and organizations build confidence in their transactions. The trust framework is a concrete tool that designers of services can use and that services can get certified against. And then we also do a lot of education and research to help adopters to better understand which messages adopters can understand and resonate, and, you know, where we need to adjust some of our language for our education. One of the things that Greg mentioned that I also think is important to call out is that the trust framework, you know, just like the words digital ID or digital identification, I find people use the words trust framework in a lot of different ways. And so sometimes that can be confusing as well. For us, the trust framework is a set of auditable criteria that help to mitigate and remove risk, and help to build assurance in different solutions and services. And so this means that the trust framework is really a risk mitigation framework that helps the adopter to have confidence in the solutions that they're adopting. I think another power of the trust framework and the way that ours has been designed is to sit as a complementary extension to technical standards and to open source. And so this means that this framework helps adopters and helps a community to not only measure the risk mitigation and assurance of a single solution built on a single technical stack, but also how to measure risk management and assurance against different solutions that may be built on different technical stacks. And for me personally, I think this is a very powerful tool, because one of the things that we see in Canada, and for those of us, you know, those of you who are working on this problem both locally and globally, we see a suite of solutions. We see a suite of technical standards and open source, and we don't see kind of a single solution. So this means that we will, something that's very important for our community as a whole is to know how we can measure trust and assurance and risk management across different communities, across different technologies, to help with that trust interoperability for how the information that goes into credentials is verified and verifiable and has not been tampered with, as well as how we can move trust through credentials and other tools between different communities, and which is certainly important for cross-border and moving across different industries. So I think that's a powerful feature of what trust frameworks can do. This trust framework is also unique in that we have taken that collaborative approach. We use a public review process where everyone from around the world has the opportunity to comment. We do dispositions of comments. So taking that collaborative public and private working together, I would say, is unique. Whereas, you know, some jurisdictions do it solely for government, from a government perspective. We've tried to do it as a collaborative approach between public and private sector. We find that people do feel, at least in our research, they report that having public and private work together helps to provide checks and balances, that they gives them more comfort and helps people to build trust. So yeah, we're really extending the technical aspects, and so this is this framework and and, you know, others, as Greg mentioned, there's certainly a handful of them out there, multiples frameworks out there. But for us, it's how do we add value, add context, and extend for things like verifiable credentials? And then also, how can these verifiable credentials or the trusted information be used in trusted networks and all the way into even traditional federation? Really, you know, helping with that extended layer. So we're a complementary tool into the work that this group is doing. And all of this is really to help reduce uncertainty for adopters. And I think Greg mentioned that last part I'll share is we've seen a lot of adoption. We know that there is the move or the adoption and the evolution from kind of traditional identity and access management or federated identity takes time. And as we move to more distributed ecosystems, use of tools like digital wallets, verifiable credentials, we will still have those kind of traditional channels that do exist. And so one of the things that we're seeing, where the areas that we're seeing adoption here is by regulators, and how a framework can help to provide an air gap for a regulator, keeping them neutral and separate from the solutions providers, and then providing a signal of auditability, of verification, and where we're seeing adoption. One of the areas that we're seeing adoption that's interesting, you know, for me at least, is law societies and lawyers. We know that it'll take time for pervasively available, usable, verifiable credentials for people to hold these in their trusted devices. So this actually also helps with the adoption of things like other types of solutions that would do photo ID capture, comparing photo IDs to known counterfeit characteristics, using traditional credit file methods and combinations of credit file and photo ID check. So we know that there will be a continuum of the shift and adoption of these technologies. And so we're also seeing a lot of adoption in this space on something that is a predecessor to something like verifiable credentials, which is important to help our communities step through the adoption chain as they would eventually, we hope, and one of our visions is that eventually there will be pervasively available government issued identity credentials, as well as private sector issued identity credentials. So we're part of a supporting our tool is one of the supporting tools, the PCTF, to help with a comprehensive risk management approach that helps adopters and helps people like lawyers or others who are professionals who we need, you know, the professionals at the front lines of trust to know that they can adopt a particular, they can use a particular technology or solution, and they know that it's been verified, which protects the adopter, that they have invested in the care of their clients, their customers, their users, and helps the ultimately, and most importantly, the person who is, you know, using these tools to know that these tools have been verified and that they're within the expectation of care for that person's data and that person's experience as they're using those tools. So it is a collaborative, the work that we all do as a community is collaborative. Sometimes we're working on kind of overlapping pieces of the puzzle. Sometimes we're working on, you know, wholly different pieces of the puzzle. So I appreciate the opportunity to share what our experience has been and where we're going. And certainly verifiable credentials will play an important role. Trust registries will play an important role. Digital wallets, while we step through the chain and traditional federation and trusted network operators, and kind of we'll have multiples of how we do verification in society. So we're proud to be one part of that, working collaboratively in an ecosystem. And we thank you for the time today to share our experience.
Thank you. Thanks, Tony.
We didn't go into details on the. I'd refer you to the PCTF website itself for all the details, but we wanted to kind of position where the trust frameworks sit and how they are valuable relative to the work of bodies like this. And that was
great. Thank you. Any questions for Gregory or Tony? You can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue. I'll throw in one question, Joni. So earlier you mentioned about most of the people, they don't really know what digital identity is or what the values are. So can you share some insights, like, in regards to what are the top 3 to 5 value that resonates with adopters? In other words, when you're trying to convince someone to adopt digital identity, like, what are the top 3 to 5 bullet points that can get them to adopt it?
Yeah, we, thank you for that question. And one of the, so how we've come up with the data around, understanding what the audience is understanding, what they don't understand, is we've used a qualified third party research firm. We've done 4 waves of research across Canada, both legal, both, official languages, and across the entire country. And so we've got data both point in time for 4 different research waves. And then we've got data over time for how perceptions have changed. And, you know, what we have seen is that when we ask people about digital identity or digital ID, it's low. We've only, their understanding is low. We've only just gotten over 50% being able to conjure some kind of definition for digital ID or digital identity. We've seen that, 23% are just unsure. We see about 55%. Once we do explain it, or they do kind of have an idea, that they feel positive about it, they see benefits. We see 23% are really unsure, and 22% are highly, highly skeptical. So, you know, it's really just about a 50-50 split there between the people seeing benefits across from those who are unsure and those who are very skeptical and have a negative perception. What we do find, and based on that research, we've committed to undertaking a storytelling campaign. So you're going to see that coming out of our organization as the fall approaches, using what we call, you know, if you're Canadian, we're using Tim Hortons language. And what we mean there is coffee shop language, using language that just kind of an average person can understand. Very plain, non-technical. So that's one of the things that we find. One pillar is use very plain language. Don't use technical speak. That technical speak is relevant when we're speaking with each other as professionals in the space. When we're speaking with adopters who could be lawyers, they could be my mom, they could be ministers or deputy ministers in government. That plain language is always a winning approach, to lean away from the technical. We find that leaning into the capabilities, the specifics, is more useful. So we find that talking about credentials or wallets or, you know, even authentication, people understand that more than this kind of broad term of digital identity, which is kind of too wide and too confusing. So talk more specifically about the specific capability versus kind of the very broad definition. And, you know, most importantly, I would say, well, kind of plain language, most important. But next to that is talk about what it's going to do for people. So talk about the why. People don't necessarily want, they don't wake up in the morning wanting to adopt digital identity. They want to be a part of the digital economy. They want to start a business easily. They want to know that they can onboard employees, you know, meeting their obligations safely and securely. They want to know that their teams can work remotely, safely and securely. People want to know that they can manage their, dependent children in the home's records, and that they can manage their dependent senior, you know, maybe their parent who may or may not live with them. So it's all about, kind of getting things done, using digital to do it, and knowing that you're cared for, that your data is cared for. So talk more to people, talk in plain language, talk about the problems that they have in front of them that they need to solve. And then, you know, map the capabilities into it versus kind of something really big and technical and broad like digital identity, that people have a hard time understanding. So we can't expect the world to be experts, the way that a group like this is. We have to talk to them in really plain language that addresses the problems they're trying to solve every day.
Thank you. And earlier you mentioned that you noticed that there's some misinformation or disinformation in regards to digital ID. So I'm curious, What are they, and how do you kind of educate the public to kind of dispel these misinformation, disinformation?
Yes, absolutely. So thank you for that question. I'll speak in my personal context. Maybe others as well, but I've observed kind of the grand conspiracy theory of all conspiracy theories. That's really, there's always been, there are rightful concerns around digital, around surveillance capitalism, around, authoritarian governments. Like these concerns are rightful and they're valid. So I want to start there. And this is the reason that I do this work, because I felt that people's privacy was being eroded and people were not in control of data about them. And that's why I do this work. That's my why. So these are rightful concerns. That said, through the advent, through the capabilities of tools that we have now, like social media is fine-tuned to amplify conflict, aggression. It's the attention economy. And so social media is fine-tuned to kind of amplify these things that incite conflict and get an angered reaction. So we have kind of have the perfect set of tools to spread inflammatory information to get reactions out of people. And so what we, and then you kind of add in the pandemic. You add in fears around rightful fears, and confusion around the pandemic, around, local and global economies, around security. And you kind of have the perfect mix for misinformation and disinformation to flow and to be amplified. We saw that certainly, amplification around the time of the pandemic. The vaccine credential certainly was a part of that conspiracy theory kind of amplification. What would the vaccine credential be used for? Was it right or was it wrong? And I'm not here to comment on that, but certainly it was part of that conspiracy theory. And like many of us saw, even like 5G, the vaccine has microchips, lots of different conspiracy theories around that spread around. In the Canadian ecosystem, I personally was targeted by a far right wing, political leader and a particular information online media, website, who claimed that, the work that was being done around digital identity, digital ID is part of governments wanting to track and surveil and force people to get the vaccine, the COVID vaccine. So, I saw that personally. I'll speak on my own behalf, and a lot of targeted, threats and harassment campaign that flowed out of that. So, And what I'll say is, while it's a disruptive story, no one should have to go through that. No one should have to go through that type of online and targeted harassment, myself included. We also have to notice that these types of, certainly there's disinformation in there, people knowingly spreading false information for their own purposes, which is often to destabilize societies. And often targets women and, visible minorities or other vulnerable populations. But then the misinformation is, I've had friends who were sharing disinformation and I had to sit down and explain to them what digital identity was. And once I did, they said, oh no, that's fine. I want that. So I had firsthand experience with people of that nature. But then, the other important piece is that when people, when misinformation and disinformation does flow and it moves around what I'll call an unauthenticated space, like Twitter, for example, or Reddit, it actually causes governments and private sector to stop their work, on protecting people and protecting their data, and to move more into a defensive posture, and to even sometimes keep information quieter when in fact we need more transparency. But we do need to more transparency about this work and what it is and what it means for people and why we're doing it. and not less transparency. But we do have to meet people where they are. And we do have to know that the goal is not to get everyone to want to use this technology, because that's not going to happen. The goal is to help people have better information, to make better choices about the tools that they use, and to help inform policy, as it goes forward, to properly govern and regulate, these types of technologies.
Got it. And kind of change the topic, I'm just curious, like, what's the difference or similarities, between the Canadian trust framework versus like EU, European Union standards? And obviously it's quite different from the US paradigm, but can you kind of highlight the similarities and differences?
Yeah. So, in the EU, so the European Union takes has taken and is currently taking a more regulatory approach. And, you know, what we've seen over time with the EIDAS, regulatory framework and digital signatures and moving toward a single digital market for, EU citizens and residents to be able to access services. So it's taking a very government regulatory top down approach. And regarding the EU DI, the digital wallet implementation, work, we could debate on whether it's strategically sound to put particular technologies into the regulatory framework. I'm not here to make a view on whether that's right or that's wrong. I think that's debatable. So certainly there's a more regulatory based approach in the European ecosystem. In the Canadian ecosystem, and I like to think about Canada and in fact the US, you know, we're all federations in Canada. It's provinces and territories in the federal government. In the US, it's states in the federal government. Now, we do have less provinces and territories than in Canada than the US has states. But still, we're all a collaborative. The US has taken a much less, hands-on approach. And we know there's a new 863 document out. So maybe folks were reading that over the weekend, and that's certainly exciting. Where 863 was really built for private sector to offer services to the federal government. And a lot of the work over the last 5 to 10 years has been to make that work, NIST 863 more usable in the private sector, for example. In Canada, we also have a flavor of there's even an identity assurance framework in where I am in British Columbia that is specific to British Columbia. So we have both jurisdictional regulatory schemes, federal regulatory schemes. In Canada, our finance is federally regulated, but our education and our health, for example, is provincially regulated. So we are all sitting kind of at the intersections of federal and jurisdictional regulation, and then non-regulated spaces as well. So I do think that we have a lot in common. We're all trying to solve similar challenges and bring similar opportunities to our populations. But the cultural aspects and the governance aspects, there are differences. In Canada, we do have a robust corporate registry, you know, jurisdictional and federal registries. I know that, you know, I think that that's a bit lacking in the US, for example. So we all have to work with what our strengths are, and work across our challenges as well, and work with our cultures and what our citizens and residents and society culturally expect, which might be a bit different, from one jurisdiction to the next. So I think we have a lot of similarities, but then, Canada, I think, sits a little bit in the middle space between, EU, which is very regulated, and US, which is very not regulated. I think we kind of sit in the middle, you know, between those two poles of approach.
Cool. Thank you. Anyone have any other questions?
Stop sharing this, Pearson.
And, I'm just curious, like, since we're talking about wallets, I think, you know, like, in the old, like, the existing federated identity system, I think we've seen that Google and Facebook emerge as the dominant players, right? Essentially, it becomes a centralized system. And then now with wallets, know, it does appear that there are numbers that's showing that Apple and Google are probably going to win the wallet war, right, with quite significant market share. And so I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts in regards to the potential dominance of Apple and Google kind of platforms over the kind of the wallet wars, for lack of better terms, or if it's not really a concern. And if it is a concern, like, what can we do to kind of mitigate this kind of re-centralization of power?
Right. So for people in that, that's a great question. For people in this group, and you may know or be familiar with, Nat Sakamura, former Nomura Research Institute in Japan. Nat has a great video, on YouTube where, you know, he talks about the kind of the paradox of decentralization, which is it's kind of always leading back to centralization. You know, decentralized when it's successful is kind of trying to push you to one network stack or one, approach. So there's a little bit of a paradox there in that, you know, the decentralized approach does tend to lead back to centralization. And often, the decentralized approach, in order to, when you need to do transactions of value or transactions that have risk, quite often intermediaries are the way that you get those things done to build in those, protective structures that you're looking for. So, I mean, these are kind of philosophical points around centralization and decentralization that I feel like probably people in this group could sit around a table and debate and be quite pleased to have that debate. For the wallet specifically, you know, I'll say I'm in the Apple ecosystem as a person that not only does this work, but as a user, I have a phone, a computer, a watch, an iPad. So I've made a decision, and then also context has, you know, helped with some of those decisions, to be in that ecosystem. So I do use my Apple Wallet quite a bit. And I think that, and where we do see a lot of this use on wallets is payments. People are getting more familiar with it. I think that the question comes forward with what can be done is, you know, governments have, I would argue, you know, the authority here, in terms of using their influence and using, the authoritative levers that they do have, both at a federal and jurisdictional level, to try to help push, along with, different jurisdictions like the EU to try to help, push, large platforms to conform to a set of criteria to that they are caring for people's data as people would expect their data to be cared for, that lock-in is avoided. That said, you know, back with my user hat on, if there was sets of criteria, if there was testing, if there was guidance, and a large platform provider like Apple could meet that bar, I would be happy to have my government credential in my Apple wallet. But that's a big if, right? And that's where the policy and regulatory can be an influencer to help, you know, bring large platform providers to where they are more respectful of people's data. Really where these tools come into play is, you know, there should be an ecosystem of wallets, that people can know, digital wallets that people can know have met certain criteria that are trustworthy. And some people will want to use those platform wallets and some people will want to use independent wallets. And we all also know that the choice of where the credential gets issued to is up to the issuer, can be up to the issuer. So I think that the issuers will also help to drive that market. We'll have to see about, you know, which goals are most important. And, you know, are we going for more adoption, which might say, okay, large platform providers have an important role to play here. And if they can meet criteria, then great. This is my personal view. and we want to promote choice. And so we know that, you know, one of the things our research shows as well is that choice is an important feature to help people have trust. Some people will only trust, you know, those large platform big names. Some people will only trust independent and open source. Some people will only trust governments. So that we can have a level playing field with tools like frameworks and regulatory schemes, and with sound and transparent and open technical standards and open source, we all have a part to play in this. So we don't have an answer, but I do think all these pieces come together, and I think, you know, especially regulatory has a role to play here, along with working with private sector, working around technical standards and regulatory frameworks.
Cool. Thank you. And we only have 3 minutes. I just want to ask one last question, which is, what are the upcoming latest developments or initiatives that you guys are working on? Like you mentioned about some educational pieces that's coming out. Can you kind of preview a little bit more?
Yeah. So first, I want to thank Greg Natron. He's pretty modest. He was our technical, he was our lead technical editor for version one of the PCTF. So, you know, with Greg being in this group, you have somebody that you can always lean on who knows the ins and outs of the DIAC's work on the PCTF and our collaboration. So I want to thank Greg for that and his role and recognize him.
Thank you. And I'm still participating, just not as editor.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Greg. So yeah, please always feel free to ask Greg some questions around that. And then, I mentioned that the two newest components are the, digital wallet, which is auditable criteria, can work with any different technology, on top of. So the digital wallet component and then the, trust registries component to help, organizations who are managing authoritative data in their ecosystem. So like for us at DIAC, we're a trust registry for who's certified. So you have lots of trust registries out there. So I would say look at those pieces from technical aspects, from the framework side. And then we're doing a lot of work, around an educational storytelling campaign in plain language, which is really to help, those adopters, which is often people who don't speak our language, who don't know the technology, who are not digital identity and access management experts, and helping with the language and the stories and the messages that help to resonate with them. So look for that storytelling campaign, and look for more education, advocacy, and research on our side. So those two sides of the house around the storytelling and the education and the research, look for that in the fall from coming out from our organization. And then we continue on a yearly basis, unless ecosystem conditions push sooner, we do continue to evolve the PCTF criteria. And I would say look at the digital wallet component, look at the trust registry component, and we've just re-released authentication as well. So you can pull those from the shelf and have a look at those. And just keep in mind that they will work as complementary to and on top of the W3C work, or IETF work, or open source. So yeah, this is a complementary tool. So I would look there.
Well, thanks. Look forward to it. Well, thank you. Thank you, Tony. And thanks, Gregory, again, for coming here today to present the Pan-Canadian Trust Framework and also share your thoughts on that. So thanks a lot. All right, so this concludes this week's CCG meeting. Thanks everyone for attending.
I think you got one. Sorry, Harrison. I think you got one hand up. Maybe.
Phil, do you have any questions? Oh, no, I think he just probably pressed the wrong button.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
Thank you for having us.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.